Today on Maine Calling, a plan to end hunger and promote food equity. The state of Maine is engaged in a comprehensive effort to end hunger by the end of the decade. And the aim is not just to provide calories, but food that is affordable, sustainable, nutritious, high quality, and culturally connected. The concept of food equity calls for all people to be able to grow and consume healthful and affordable sustenance. I'm Keith Shortall, and as many of us plan for family gatherings around abundant Thanksgiving tables, others will be scrambling to get something to eat as they face high energy bills, high food bills, or other barriers. Today on the program, we'll check in on the progress of Maine's Roadmap to End Hunger by 2030 plan, and the work of Good Shepherd Food Bank, among other groups focused on the road to food equity. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible by Welsh & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welshforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, strengthening Maine's coastal and island communities through education, health, and support. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Tomorrow is set aside as a day of thanks and as a day for plates overflowing with food. But that's not necessarily so for many people. Food insecurity is widespread in Maine, and that's why there's a sweeping statewide plan in place to end hunger by the end of the decade. Today we'll learn more about what's being done and what it would mean to achieve food equity for all. My guests today, Kristen Maley, president of Good Shepherd Food Bank, and Craig Lepine, facilitator of the Project to End Hunger by 2030. He's with Maine's Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. We invite you to join the conversation. Email talk@mainepublic.org. You can post a comment on social media or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Craig Lepine, I'll start with you. According to Feeding America, about 1 in 10 Maine households faces hunger. For children, it's 1 in 6. Whatever the number is right now, it's a lot. And I guess the first question is, why?
Yeah, it is a lot, and it's something that every Maine person should be concerned with. And I think one thing to be clear about, one of the things that's not necessarily behind it, although the pandemic certainly exposed challenges in our food supply chain, it's not really about the amount of food that we have. It's about the economic security or insecurity that a lot of Maine families experience. And so, you know, the drivers of hunger in this state, as I think the drivers of hunger in the rest of the country, really have to do with the availability of good paying jobs and the availability of the resources that help people get into and stay in the workforce.
And let's start also by clarifying terms when we talk about what we mean by hunger and by food insecurity. Can you just sort of explain the basics of the terminology that we're using?
I can try, and I may rely on my co-panelist, Kristen Maley, for the more specific definitions. But basically, we talk about two groups of people. There are people who are food insecure. They're people that, because of the financial stability of the household, may have trouble accessing food today, but are perhaps not necessarily not accessing food today. And then there are people, so those are people with low food security. And then there are people experiencing very low food security, which the USDA used to call hunger, and which I think we still call hunger, meaning people are their status is such that they have to skip meals. The quality of what they're consuming is going down. Kristen, can I kick that one to you?
No, Craig, you did a great job. And those really are kind of the two distinctions that the USDA makes. And a lot of folks say, why don't you just call it hunger? And I think by including food insecurity beyond just the extreme case, which is that people are actually skipping meals and literally going hungry, is it recognizes that even if you're not hungry because you were able to get food, you are food insecure in that you are constantly concerned on your ability to get food again. And that living with that kind of insecurity causes a toxic stress on families and on individuals that is definitely a state that that has to be rectified. And it's important to measure that and recognize how detrimental even the fear of being hungry has on individuals and families.
Kristen, I wonder if you could help us put a face on this, because we opened with a statistic about 1 in 10. With all these numbers, it's easy to forget that we're talking about individual human beings, about families. So what does that look like? What does a food insecure household look like, you know, say at 11 o'clock or at lunchtime on the day before Thanksgiving in Maine? What are the what sort of food choices, if any, are happening?
Sure. Well, one is that hunger affects all demographics, and it's everywhere in the state. This isn't just something that happens in our rural communities or in our urban communities. It is everywhere. And as Craig alluded to, hunger also is now affecting working families. That's another surprise for many people, is that the majority of people who are experiencing food insecurity and hunger in Maine are working. And they just, however, are not earning enough money to make ends meet. And so, for example, I actually just met a woman just last week who actually came up to us. I was with a group of colleagues and they saw we were wearing Good Shepherd clothes and came up to thank us for our work and shared her story that she lost a job during the pandemic. She has a new job. She's working, her daughter's working and living with her, caring for a grandchild. Between the two of them, they just don't earn enough money. And so they're going to their local food pantry to help make ends meet. And so hopefully for a lot of families, they are able to access food through the Charitable Food Network. And I know our partners, this is one of their busiest weeks of the year because there's a lot of additional food supports to allow families to have that normalcy of sitting together and having a Thanksgiving dinner and how important that is. So our partners, we have 600 partners around the state that are very busy this week, making sure they are open and allowing people to come and get their food needs met. But we also like to remind people hunger does not know the difference between a holiday. And next Thursday is going to be just as difficult as this Thursday.
Yeah, so, I was going to say, there's sort of another side to this where everyone's very conscious of this the week before Thanksgiving, and we're all in a giving mood. But the point is that, you know, Thanksgiving comes and goes and Christmas comes and goes, and this will persist into January when there are no holidays to remind us or officially to be thankful. So I assume you have to plan, look ahead to the post-Thanksgiving enthusiasm.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of our partners get a lot of attention this time of year. There are a lot of community food drives, which is very helpful. But then as we hit especially the winter months in Maine, where the need usually increases because of the cost of heating our homes is so high, and we know these pandemic era SNAP benefits, SNAP expansions, they're going to end after the new year as well. And so next, especially as we head into January, February, March, we are going to need probably even more support than these programs need now. So it's incredibly important to remember this is a year-round situation. Another, you know, you talked about what it looks like that we hear also is a lot. Oftentimes it also looks like, you know, kids coming home from school and not having any food there to have an afternoon snack. And we talk about how important that or how toxic that food insecurity is. I've also heard stories of kids who grew up in food insecure homes, and even though they're now still in stable situations, that scarcity and that fear of not having enough stays with them sometimes for decades after that experience, and how much that impacts their life even when they get into a food secure situation. So it really is a significant issue that we have to address.
And Craig, this is sort of a perfect storm brewing here, right? On to the extent that, as Kristen mentioned, some of these federal programs that got us through the pandemic and post-pandemic are running out, they're ending, at the same time that oil prices are going through the roof and food prices and prices for everything are going up. These are the conditions, I'm guessing, where people who are in your positions really are anxious about. And maybe anxious is not enough.
No, that's absolutely true. And if I could point out, you know, kind of the way that Good Shepherd and the state and other entities are partners here in this work, you know, what Good Shepherd is doing and all of Kristen's partners in the field, they are doing an absolutely heroic job of making sure that there are meals available where and when people need them. And on the government side, I think it's our job to make sure that there are fewer and fewer of those peoples. And those forces, Keith, that you just referenced, are hugely important and obviously out of the control, out of some, you know, some state programs. There's very little that the state can do about the cost of gasoline or inflation, but we are certainly trying to, you know, push what levers that we can. And it is unfortunate that on the federal side, we're losing some of that partnership, that some of the SNAP supplements are going away. You know, what the governor has done, for example, and Kristen just mentioned kids coming home from school, even though the federal support is going away, the state has made a commitment that universal free school meals are here to stay. And I hope that that is a permanent change. And there are other things that we are, you know, other things certainly that we're trying to do, making sure that people can get to work and that it is affordable, and whatever we can do on LIHEAP and the heating oil front, because, you know, and I'm sure everybody here who balances checkbook knows this, it's not as if a family's food budget is in some kind of lockbox separate from every other expense that they experience. And so if the rent goes up, if the heating oil bill goes up, if anything goes up, you know, the food budget gets implicated in that, and we can be pushing families closer to the edge.
So we'll talk more about what's being done and the efforts to end hunger, which is a very bold goal. But I do want to mention, get to the issue that we talked about at the very top, that I mentioned about this concept of food equity, which is about people, Kristen, right, having enough food to eat, but also about having democratic access to food. Can you explain the concept for us?
Yeah, sure. Well, food equity is making sure that everybody has access to the healthy, culturally relevant food that they need to thrive. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is that is not the case, that we do not have the same access to resources and the same access to food. And I think one thing that just became alarmingly clear during COVID, it became clear during COVID, it certainly existed pre-COVID, is that poverty and food insecurity disproportionately impacts communities of color, in addition to other marginalized populations, including the LGBTQ community. And then you look at the intersectionality of some of those identities, especially single parents or single moms. Those communities have significantly higher rates of hunger. Research that was done by the Maine Center for Economic Policy in 2019 found that Maine households of color experience food insecurity at 2 to 3 times the rate of Maine of white households. So we have some serious equity issues when it comes to food. And so that is work that that both the Ending Hunger by 2030 work that Craig referenced and Good Shepherd's work is really intentionally looking at to make sure we do not create solutions that perpetuate those inequities.
So, yeah, let's get then to the Ending Hunger project. Craig, you're at the forefront of the state's effort to end hunger by 2030. Are we heading in the right direction, even though we're in these early months and under these unusual circumstances?
You know, we had a little conversation at the top of the hour about statistics, and I wish I could say I knew. It certainly looks like we're heading in the right direction, right? In 2019, when the bill was passed in the legislature, our food insecurity rate was 12%. In 2020, it was 11.4. In 2021, it was 9.5. We seem to be heading in the right direction. We also know, as Kristen mentioned that, and as you referenced, you know, that those numbers are a little out of date and we've got inflation happening and we've got other things happening. And we fear that maybe we started heading in the other, in the wrong direction. And unfortunately, we don't have great real-time information from which we can do course corrections. What I can say is, I think one thing that we can take pride in the state is the levers that are available to us. We are trying to pull those levers. And so the degree to which the cost of housing is making people more food insecure, we are certainly trying, doing what we can to lower the cost of housing. One of the biggest things, you know, we're talking about equity and this paradox that on the one hand, hunger and food insecurity are absolutely ubiquitous in Maine. I mean, you cannot go to a PTA meeting, to a basketball game, to a Hannaford, and not be rubbing elbows with people who are experiencing food insecurity. We are everywhere. And on the other hand, this thing that Kristen pointed out, which is even though it's everywhere, it is not experienced equally. And some communities are much more deeply impacted. And so, and one of those communities, you know, kind of rooted in historical inequities are women who are heading households because they tend to make less and there tend to be fewer opportunities for them to get to work. And so I think the fact that right now the governor is trying to make childcare more affordable, more available in more communities, that there are more people moving into the childcare field, that childcare centers are getting a little bit of a bump for serving low-income families. All of those are things that are trying to say, okay, we recognize that this population in our community is being disproportionately impacted. Can we help those people get and keep the kinds of jobs that they're going to need to sustain their families?
Kristen, Good Shepherd already is now what, serving, I read, 25 or providing food for entities to provide 25 million meals a year. And I did some math, it might be wrong, but it ends up being sort of, you know, feeding the number of people in Portland like every day or something. It's an amazing number. But what is so, and you also have your own plan to end hunger by 2025. That's only a few years away. But by ending hunger, does that mean that Good Shepherd closes its doors, it's no longer needed, it's out of business, or you're going to provide many millions meals more to meet the need that you anticipate by 2025?
Yeah, so it's this is a great question because it's a really important distinction. And to me, I think that what's the strength of the Ending Hunger by 2030 plan that the state put together, that, and I will say we're saying the state put together, but they put it together with a massive collaboration of hundreds of individuals and organizations. So it was really a wonderful collaborative process. And they recognized that hunger, that we really have two different issues. One is food today and one is food tomorrow. And so food today is making sure we're addressing the urgent need that people need food now. And that is the core work of the food bank. And so when we talk about ending hunger by 2025, we're referencing that definition of making sure people have access to the food today. And that means needing to rely on the charitable food network. So we're making a commitment that our network will be providing enough meals to meet the need of that urgency of hunger today. However, we recognize while that is an important first step because people cannot work on other issues of strengthening their economic security if they're dealing with the crisis of hunger, it is just that, the first step. Needing to rely on the charitable food network is not the solution. Food banking is not the solution. We are a temporary solution while we work on the longer term goal of how do we strengthen economic security for Maine families so that they can have the experience of normalcy of going to a grocery store and buying food using their own resources. And that's really the other part of the 2030 roadmap, is recognizing that hunger does not exist in a vacuum. Hunger exists because we do not have access to affordable quality childcare, transportation, healthcare, all of these issues. And so it's really that collaboration of all of those different sectors working together to strengthen the financial security of Maine families. And that is how we're going to end hunger in the long term.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you. The number to join the conversation is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, how Maine is tackling the problem of hunger and focusing on food equity. Joining me, Craig Lapine. He is Special Assistant to the Commissioner of the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. And Kristen Maley is President of Good Shepherd Food Bank. Share your comments and questions. Email talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on our Facebook page or on Twitter or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now is Kim Lengert, Coordinator for Maine's Volunteers in Service to America. Kim, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you, Keith.
So I am old enough to remember the creation of VISTA in the early 60s, barely remember, which is, as we said, Volunteers in Service to America, which was directed at the time at poverty. Tell us about what VISTA is doing now in its work in connection with the effort to end hunger in Maine.
Our program in Maine is called the Maine Ending Hunger Corps, and that is our VISTA program that we relate to. We enable existing organizations throughout Maine that are working to end food insecurity, whether they be nonprofits and communities or educational institutions or departments within the state government, to increase their effectiveness in what they do by building their capacity through the use of VISTAs.
And so where in Maine, I guess they're spread out, but where in Maine are the volunteers actively helping?
Good Shepherd Food Bank. Kristen Maley is there, who has currently two VISTAs through our program. We have VISTAs at Preble Street. We have VISTAs as far north. We have programs in Aroostook. We have programs out in Rumsford, actually, that is currently looking for staffing right now. Along the coast, throughout Lewiston, the Portland area. Basically, if there's an area in Maine that has a food insecurity program, we are looking for either to place a new site or fill an existing site.
Yeah, so we've all experienced or have witnessed the labor shortage that's happening right now. I'm assuming this affects the volunteer pool as well. Is this an issue for your program?
It is an issue. It's an issue nationwide for AmeriCorps VISTA. With this, we're working diligently within our program through the state, through DACF, to support the local sites in ways that better enhance their ability to attract VISTAs to the program. So we're working with them to secure better housing opportunities, to better word the listings, to work with them to expand the VISTA's opportunities while they're serving. So we feel that by doing these things, we are able to make a more attractive area for these VISTAs from around the country to come and spend and use their gifts as well as learn themselves by serving in Maine.
So someone who is listening now and wants to get involved in the effort, do they have to become an official VISTA volunteer, or can they help in some other way?
I'm sure that people can help in any way. Certainly these programs that we work with are always looking for volunteers who are anxious to help throughout their communities. And for those who are in the communities, that does not prohibit them from becoming a VISTA. We are encouraging sites to choose people from their areas, people who are participating in the programs, to join through and continue to serve as a VISTA. We would help them with the registration with that. They would then receive a stipend through the program. And even though that they are a local helping out in their individual community, they could be a part of the program as a VISTA member.
Yeah, and is there a website that best to go to for someone who's interested in taking part?
Yes, they could go to DACF, and I believe I have this right. Craig can jump in to help me, I'm sure. DACF, EHC, 2030, or Ending Hunger Corps 2030. We have a website. They can also contact me at Kim, K-I-M, period, LENGERT at maine.gov.
All right, Kim Lenger, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
I am going to, if I could correct the URL, just because Kim added an extra C. Because I have that luxury of looking at it. So it's at maine.gov/DACF, that's the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry, /EH2030, Ending Hunger 2030. So
all right.
DACF/EH2030.
Rolls right off the tongue. Kim Lenger, thanks. She coordinates the VISTA volunteer program. Thanks again. Kristen, let me ask you about this volunteer question, because I guess that's another part of this perfect storm here, is the labor issues that we're having. Is Good Shepherd or any of your partner, you have over 400 partners in making this thing work. Is this a problem for you on top of rising costs, et cetera?
Yeah, so we do have an amazing group of volunteers that both volunteer at the food bank and certainly support our partner network, which is almost supported entirely by a volunteer core. So we are fortunate to have the thousands that we have, but you're right, we need even more. And so different ways of getting involved. If you want to volunteer at the food bank, we have opportunities in our Auburn and Hampton warehouses. You can go to feedingmaine.org. to get more information on how to volunteer with us. Also on our website, you can go to our food finder, put in your zip code, and it will give you the list of community-based food access organizations in your community with contact information, and reach out to see what volunteer opportunities are right there in your own community.
Calling us now is Lynn Holland, horticulture and social media professional with the UMaine Cooperative Extension. Hi, Lynn, are you with us?
Thank you.
Yes, thanks for joining us today. So the Extension operates this program called Harvest for Hunger, which does just what it sounds like it does. You get farmers in Maine to collect and to clean some of the produce that they grow, and either so they can either donate it to a local agency, or what I thought was interesting, or to just a friend in need. Tell us about what's behind that program.
So the Maine Harvest for Hunger program has been around since the year 2000, and it was based on the program Grow a Row for the Hungry, which encouraged local gardeners to grow an extra row of food in their garden and donate it to a local pantry or shelter. In 2000, one of our educators, Frank Wertheim, realized what a potential there was with our local farmers. And so he began the Maine Harvest for Hunger program along with several other educators. And since the year 2000, we've donated over 3.3 million pounds of food. And this year we're on track to probably donate somewhere upwards of 200,000 pounds of food that's been gleaned, which means, you know, harvested from local farms or farm markets or farm stands, or also from people's gardens.
And so, and the trick here, this is nutritious food, it's produce, but I guess the trick is it doesn't have a long shelf life or a varying shelf life. So it's important to get it from where it is grown and collected and cleaned to people kind of quickly, right?
Correct. And that's kind of where we hang our hat, because the Extension is an education-based institution. And so we teach Master Gardener volunteers effective food handling tips, storage tips. We help them help other organizations. So many of them join gleaning organizations, work for their local pantries. And our goal is to get the food from the farm to the person who's going to eat it as quickly as possible. So sometimes the pantry is the best route, but sometimes there's a meal program in a town where it makes more sense to bring it to them, and the person who does their cooking creates a nutritious soup, stew, or other meal that's served that very evening. In many cases, the food that is gleaned is not necessarily old or even in bad shape. It's just not profitable for the farmer to take it out of their fields and take it to market, because maybe the market's saturated already. Sometimes we bring it to a place and we process it also.
Yeah. So it's not necessarily then only a seasonal thing. It doesn't end in the fall after the harvest. This food lives on in various forms.
Right. We do have several programs that have now done some very basic processing through commercial kitchens, a lot of which is donated by local farmers. And maybe we create applesauce or squash, or maybe there's a soup made by a professional who then follows all the food safety rules. Sometimes it's just gleaning from one of the year-round producers, whether it's somebody hydroponically growing tomatoes or lettuce that has a few extra cases each week. We then bring them to a local pantry so that that food can be distributed.
Yeah. On another front, the Extension also operates the Expanded Food and Nutrition Education Program, which, again, does what it sounds like. It's to educate people and groups about nutrition and physical activity. And I'm guessing the existence of this program suggests that there is this belief that learning about nutrition, learning about the importance of good nutrition, about the importance of exercise, will influence people to take care of themselves, to pay attention to that more than if they lack information.
Absolutely. And one of the things about a lot of the food recovery networks, especially the bigger you get, is sometimes the food is calorie dense, but not necessarily nutritionally dense. So by educating consumers, whether they're food insecure or not, that, you know, this choice might be better for your family than that choice, we've created a better decision at the family level, a decision that's better for the family and that one that they make themselves, because dignity is really important. People want to be able to feed their family, right? And they want to feel like it's them making that decision, not literally getting a handout.
Yeah, thank you. Lynn Holland, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you. Lynn Holland is with the UMaine Cooperative Extension for Aroostook and Sagadahoc counties. Kristen, you heard there this effort of educating people. I'm wondering, I was just thinking also about providing food isn't the only goal here. It's not just providing, you know, a sheet cake to someone. It's providing food that it's good calories. And so that's a very important part of it as well, right?
Absolutely. We often know, Craig alluded to, when people are experiencing food insecurity, they often make trade-offs. And one of the trade-offs that all too often happens is having to trade off healthier food, which tends to be more expensive, in order to get enough calories. And unfortunately, our U.S. food system does an amazing job of having an abundance of calories at very inexpensive prices without much nutritional value. And we all have seen the prices of things like milk and eggs and meat and produce. And so the food bank has really made an intentional mission change several years ago to focus on improving access to healthy food, not just any food. And so we now have a nutrition policy. The food bank does not distribute soda, candy, or desserts. And then we also, partnering with Cooperative Extension, we also offer a nutrition and education program called Cooking Matters, recognizing that oftentimes it's really hard to make, you know, helping families make those healthy food choices while on a limited budget. And being able to do that means you really need to know how to cook from scratch. And a lot of people just weren't taught those life skills. And so that's an important component as well, for sure.
Right. If you don't know what to do with a spaghetti squash, it's probably going to sit on there. And we have seen in schools where schools have attempted to introduce nutritious foods, vegetables and fruits, and they often stay on the tray and are thrown away. Is that a problem not only in schools, but in households as well? As you're trying to provide nutritious food, but maybe it's not being greeted as much as other favorites?
Yeah, so it used to be that was frequent. We have a program called Mainers Feeding Mainers, where we forward contract with Maine food producers to grow food for our network. And so they were just growing a variety of vegetables. And we did hear initially people were like, what is that? What's that delicata squash? What's kale? Like, this was all new foods for a lot of folks. And we also realized when you're operating on a limited budget, people are hesitant to dare try a new food and pay for it. Because what if their kids don't like it? What if they don't like it? They can't take that chance and waste that food. And so what, by able to, by, as we were offering a much wider variety of vegetables and encouraging folks to try it. And now we hear partners saying, people are asking, when's that delicata squash coming into season again? And so we have been able to really expand people's just exposure to a wider variety of vegetables. And now our vegetables move incredibly fast. We actually, as fast as they come in, they go right out the door again. So we are seeing that being less and less of an issue.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you. We promised to go to the phones. We're talking about hunger and food equity. The number to join the conversation is 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Our topic today, what Maine is doing to put an end to hunger and to build food equity. My guests, Kristen Maley with Good Shepherd Food Bank and Craig Lepine with Maine's Project to End Hunger. Join the conversation, the number 800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. I'm going to go to the phones now as promised, and we'll talk with Catherine, who's calling from Washington County. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the program.
I had wanted to make a comment. I'm not sure how many others might have experienced this same situation, but at one time I had to be on the SNAP program, and what I had experienced, one specific situation was that with particular medical issues, I at the time had a real digestion issues where there were only certain foods that I really could easily eat and feel good about it. I had experienced going to a grocery store and buying just they had a very good deal on a half of a sandwich that they priced very, very reasonably, and thinking that that would be, you know, that's all I needed for lunch, and bringing it to the cashier and finding out at that particular point of the sale that they did not allow prepared foods, which I hadn't known before, on the program. And it was quite embarrassing to, you know, stop the line of people there to sort this out with a manager. And it was very, very difficult. And I didn't have any way to cook food at the time. And I was on my lunch break from work. And it was quite difficult to find any other ready-to-eat food at the time that was as easy to eat. And I wondered how many other people might have had the same situation where they were prevented from getting a particular type of food that would have been quite suitable for them because of that restriction and the stigma that went along with that.
Yeah. Catherine, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. Kristen, it helps, again, as we said earlier, we're talking about people who you know, who are just trying to get a basic need met, and yet they're facing these barriers. So we appreciate when those stories are shared. I'm sure you hear those stories too, Kristen.
We hear stories like this far too often. And Catherine, I'm so sorry that you had to experience that as well. Unfortunately, as amazing as our SNAP program is, it is by far our nation's number one defense against hunger. We still have too many forces that are so concerned with abuse that there's absolutely no evidence that it even exists. And they put up unnecessary barriers that instead all they do is just affect the dignity of experience and just perpetuate this prevailing public narrative that somehow it's some kind of individual failure why someone is experiencing food insecurity. So it's definitely something we're constantly fighting against, and it needs to change.
I'm going to try
can
to.
Can I piggyback on that?
Sure,
Keith,
go ahead.
Sir, thanks.
Go ahead, Greg.
You know, I think it's a good way also to circle back to the conversation we were having before the break about education and the wonderful programs that Lynn is running with Cooperative Extension and Cooking Matters. And I spend a lot of my career supporting school gardens where there was a lot of education happening. And there is absolutely a place for that. And what I think the caller's experience shows is that, just respecting people's autonomy and believing that they know what's best for them is almost invariably the best place to proceed from. And since we're talking about equity today, I think if we can do one thing to advance equity, it would be to not frame the conversation in terms of how people who may be struggling are falling short, but really hold up the mirror and think about how we are all falling short as a community if we have so many people in these situations.
I want to bring in another guest. I'm going to try to bring him in, but I'm not sure if he is truly connected. Alan Kryzak, are you with us? Can you hear me? Let's see.
Hello?
Oh, there he is. You are there.
Yeah.
Great.
How you doing?
Good, thank you. My system was suggesting maybe you were tucked away on hold somewhere. Welcome to the program. You're a filmmaker who has a new documentary called Hungry Now, and it's airing tomorrow on Thanksgiving at 9 p.m. on Maine Public Television. And so we appreciate you spending a few minutes here to talk with us about the film. First of all, congratulations. And I've read, I haven't seen it, but I've read that it sort of sets out to tell, as we just heard, some of the personal stories of, you know, real people who have experienced homelessness, who have been food insecure. Why was it important for you to shine a light on this?
Thanks for having me on, Keith. The idea with the film was trying to connect the disassociation that people have. The biggest discovery made with the film is that, unlike today's program, which is great, sympathetic towards hungry people, there are a lot of people out there who think the hungry or the struggling are just lazy. So the great thing about a documentary is you can have these interviews, you can have the other side of the coin where they really think some of the working poor are just sitting at home waiting for handouts. And I was able to flash the minimum wage on screen, amplifying Kristen's comment that it's not about giving things out in the future. It's about economic security. So one of the first things you discover is these people working one or two jobs are hungry there because they're making $7.25 an hour, which is the minimum wage since 2009. So the Congress that hasn't changed that in 13 years, they make $50 an hour with 200 paid days off a year. And I have people at a restaurant or a diner out in Eastport saying the people are hungry or homeless because they're lazy. So that's all in there. You know, I don't censor anybody. You say what you have to say. And the best part of it was just going out into the streets in Bangor all the way to Eastport, talking to people who were, who I found out the poorest people were the first to help, and the most comfortable people were the first to blame.
Yeah, right. So it sort of blows apart, I think, these judgments that we tend to make about groups of people, and reminds us that there's this oftentimes a confluence of life experiences that come together to create these challenges that people are simply just trying to overcome.
Exactly. And I went backwards in time and thought, well, where is this starting from? Because every homeless person I talked to, every single one said they ran away from home in middle school. Oh, not high school, but 12, 13 years old. So I worked with the Cops Cook Tree program, this amazing experiment in Jonesport and Millbridge, and I was let into the classroom seeing what teachers really do for a living. Besides, you know, you only hear about teachers if they're in trouble or if they're on strike. You see what this great work is with teachers and counselors, and we have food insecure 12-year-olds, food insecure middle schoolers, and this program works with all of those angles, right up to abuse, giving somebody a ride so they're safe to a job, all the way to having a small food pantry inside the school, take a couple extra cans of stuff on the way home on a Friday. So I'm looking at these kids who are potentially at risk, trying to find out is there anything we can do to have this 12-year-old not turn into Jonathan, you know, the guy who gave me back my food card, my Dunkin' card, and said give it to them by the dumpster because they needed more. So trying to find out what the difference is. As the one homeless guy said, I used to drive by homeless people with my daddy when I was young, and I didn't know who they were. And he just skipped 20 years and said, I don't know how I got here, but I got here somehow. And that's what the movie tries to answer. Yeah. How did you get there?
And so what would you like the audience to take away?
I think just an empathy of seeing that the homeless people I talked to, they don't want more handouts. They want a functional life. One said, you know, I have this state income coming in. I like to pay for an apartment, not to be in a tent by the river. I like to pay for an apartment. And he wanted to help other businessmen, like make money off of him, saying, if I have some money coming in, I'm gonna put it into the community. This is a man in a wheelchair who just got mugged 2 days earlier. So the homeless people just want a way to work and live and function. And the working poor, like Byrne from Passamaquoddy, single mom, she just wants her kids to have a good life. And if it takes working two jobs, she does it. But I think the main message is you don't really know what these people are going through. And a lot of them are working poor because, like I said, the minimum wage hasn't moved in 13 years. It's like everybody has a lifeboat, but every single lifeboat has a hole in it.
Yeah. Alan Krizak, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Keith.
Alan Krizak with Downey's documentary. His film, Hungry Now, airs on Maine Public Television tomorrow night at 9 o'clock. Let's bring in, let's bring in Doug in Portland. Hi, Doug. Welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Doug Horner. I'm the director of the Stroudwater Food Pantry. And just wanted to circle back to Kristen's earlier commentary about meal inequity, food inequity. One of the many points I think we need to address in that discourse is infrastructure, and specifically the ability to get the food to where the people are. We have a household delivery program serving more than 100 households at this time. And one of the things we found is that we cannot put ourselves in a position where we're dependent on meal insecure families coming to us. We have to be able to go to them when they can't come to us. The qualifications for home delivery for us is that if someone cannot afford an automobile, or if they have, for instance, a medical condition that prevents them from driving, then we go to them and we take them their box of groceries. So I think that we need to keep an eye on the fact that that infrastructure is needed, whether it is to get food to the apartments where people live, or if they're living in a hotel, which actually is its own specialized diet. We need to be able to go where the people are and keep an eye on going to where the people are if we're going to make a big dent in the meal insecurity issues we're facing.
Doug, thank you so much for joining us. Kristen, just a few minutes left here. I guess we could wrap up on maybe coming off of what Doug said. What is it that we should all be doing here looking forward?
Yeah, so great to hear from Doug. He's a wonderful partner and doing amazing work in Portland and Westbrook. So thanks, Doug, for all your work and your volunteers. You know, I almost want to end with where Craig said at the very beginning of the show. Ending hunger, is the issue of hunger has nothing to do with food, and while individual acts can have an amazing impact on addressing the urgency of hunger today, individual acts will not end hunger tomorrow. And that the sole reason why we have food insecurity in Maine, in the United States, is because we as a community have chosen to allow it. We have enough food, we have enough funding, we have resources, we have programs that effectively meet the needs of people. That has all been figured out. We just choose not to fund it appropriately to make sure everybody has access to healthy food. So we have chosen to allow this to happen. And the most important thing anyone can do is help us make a different choice.
Craig Lepine, 30 seconds.
Could not agree more with my friend and colleague, Kristen. We create poverty by the choices we make, and we are always free to make different choices. And I think we've started to, and I hope we continue to. And I hope people will hold, you know, Maine has made this commitment to end hunger by 2030. And I hope the people of Maine will hold us accountable to that, because we really need to get there.
All right. Thank you both for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Kristen Maley is with Good Shepherd Food Bank. Craig Lepine is with the statewide project to end hunger by 2030. Today's sound engineer was KG Akinmiladun. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Visit mainecalling.org for our audio archive and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. I'm Keith Shortall, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. Happy Thanksgiving.